On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Microsoft reorgs Windows, Linux ends up on Windows, the FCC prefers Windows, and Elon wants to make Windows into space. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 284, recorded March 30th, 2018, Low China Orbit. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Cloud Spanner from Google Cloud Platform. Cloud Spanner is the only horizontally scalable and strongly consistent relational database service. To learn more, visit g.co/getspanner today. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. This is the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Palliser, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I can't guide you by myself. I'm going to need the help of my friends, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin. That's right, Curtis. He is the, I'm going to say, the spiritual wisdom of our Twyatt group. Curtis, how are you doing, my friend?
Well, I'm going to have trouble living up to that billing, but doing quite well here on a rainy Friday in Central Florida. Things are looking good. Been following all kinds of security fun this week, getting ready to head to RSA in a couple of weeks, and making progress toward finding a permanent home for the Florida studio of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Well, you know, you could always move to Rome with me. We've got some rooms over there. I got a studio, mostly. So
believe me, I'll keep that in mind.
Actually, Curtis, the last time we met was at Enterprise Connect in Orlando. That was, what, just 2 weeks ago. And I have to say, I'm getting incredibly impressed by that show. It grows every year. And this year, the attendees seem to be a much higher, I'm going to say, vendor quality than it has been in your past. What was your experience of EC?
No, I'll agree with you. And I'll tell you, I think that the difference is that rather than being people who somehow are tangentially related to what happens on the ground in Enterprise Connect or Enterprise Communications, there were people who were actually, you know, from the vendor standpoint, looking to sign purchase orders. And from the deployment aspect, people who were really managing these projects. So there was a good vibe that tends to be around people who are actually making things happen. I was very impressed with what was going on there.
That always makes a conference more enjoyable, because you and I both know that you go to any of these conferences and maybe half the attendees are there because they're collecting swag, and maybe their company paid for them to be at the thing. And so that's why they're there. Didn't feel like that this year at Enterprise Connect. I'm interested in seeing how that conference continues to grow. I think it's probably taken over the interop spot because the Unified Communications is the hot spot. But we'll talk about that later. Let's get over to the other co-host of the show, the man, the myth, the geek in paradise. That's right. It's Chibert. Brian Chi, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Chibert, in the past 48 hours, I've gone from a place that was snowing to a place that was 86 degrees. What's it like in Hawaii?
Actually, it's nice. You know, it's been raining cats and dogs the last couple of days on the windward side, but it's been dry as a bone on the Honolulu side. Very strange. Now, I got to jump into that conversation about Enterprise Connect. When we did that Unified Communications iLabs at Interop, huge amount of people interested. We were doing lots of really neat things. UC was really and truly changing. And it's now being woven as part of a lot of corporations, a lot of large organizations. And so I was thinking, geez, you know, they should do an entire show on this. And, well, they did.
Yeah. It's interesting because UC grew out of a niche in Interop, and now UC, Enterprise Connect, which is the UC show for UBM, they're kind of spreading out to do things that were not traditionally UC. Go figure. It's like the tail eating the dog. But let's not talk about tails eating dogs. And instead, let's get to the show. Now, I should mention it's going to be a shortened show because we had a problem with our guest. We were going to have a guest from VMware. We love those shows, but the quality was bad. We were having a Skype issue. So instead, we're going to give you all the best of our blips and our bites. Let's go ahead and start it off with Microsoft doing a major reorg. Now, the Nadella reorganization of Microsoft continues with no part of the company spared. Now, this time, he's going after the former sacred cow of Redmond, Windows itself. In an open letter from Satya Nadella to Microsoft employees, the cloud-centric CEO once again shared his vision for intelligent cloud and intelligent edge and announced several bullet point items. First, Terry Myerson, who helmed Windows and devices starting in 2013, is leaving the company. Myerson had been with Microsoft since 1997 when his company was acquired by Microsoft and has run Windows Phone, which of course was a huge flop, but also WDG with such hits as Surface, Xbox, Server, and HoloLens. Now, his division is being divided between experiences and devices, led by Executive Vice President Rajesh Jha, and a new division named Cloud Plus AI Platform run by EVP Scott Guthrie. Some analysts and fanboys went crazy at the news, but anybody who has been keeping score has seen Nadella's cloud-first strategy pay off in spades. And this is just more of that. Specifically, with the reorganization, Nadella positions Windows to get the 365 treatment, which has been hugely profitable for Redmond. Myerson is staying with the company until the transition is complete, and there will be layoffs associated with the reorganization. But for this Redmond watcher, this was a move a long time coming.
When it comes to data breaches, the cure can be worse than the disease. A study presented last week at the 4A Security and Compliance Conference shows that, at least when it comes to hospital security breaches, the type and scale of a breach doesn't have an impact on patient outcomes, but the hospital's response does. Now, the effect is serious. Mortality rates go up significantly following remediation. Dr. Sung Choi, a postdoc at Vanderbilt, looked at a common metric available to researchers, the 30-day mortality rate from AMI, or acute myocardial infarction, which is basically how many people who come through the hospital door with a heart attack are still alive 30 days later. Now, that mortality rate has been falling for at least the last 5 years, but according to the study, the increase in 30-day AMI mortality rate after a breach was comparable to undoing a year's worth of improvement in that rate. What happens? Well, new access and authentication procedures, new protocols, and new software after any breach incident will disrupt clinicians and cause problems with care. And those problems have numbers attached. There are an additional 35 to 45 deaths per 1,000 heart attack discharges every year for these organizations. So the lesson, well, it's clear. If you're going to have a heart attack, make sure your hospital has been breach-free for at least a year.
Oh, I just cannot leave that alone. Does that mean law enforcement can now charge hackers that breach a hospital with manslaughter? What do you think, Kurt?
You know. That there are ambitious district attorneys who will be looking at exactly that in the years to come. And this study's not over. I talked to the researcher, and I'm going to be following up on this because he's got even more numbers coming up having to do with ransomware and things like that.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. So bring your own Linux to Windows with a new open source tool. So after starting with Ubuntu, Microsoft has added a number of Linux distributions to its Windows subsystem for Linux, called WSL, Linux runtime environment. A Windows machine can simultaneously offer an Ubuntu, SUSE, Debian, and Kali personality, providing users with a choice of different distributions' preferences and package management. But if your distribution isn't available yet, or if you want a Linux installation that's customized just the way you like it, there's now an answer. Microsoft has an open source tool for building your own Linux package. The tool is aimed at two groups. distribution owners so they can produce a bundle to ship through the Microsoft Store, and developers so they can create custom distributions and sideload them onto their development systems. Theoretically, anyone could take a distribution of their choice and package it for the store, but Microsoft says that it will only accept such packages from distribution owners. Anyone hoping to stick Fedora in the store, it was promised last year but is yet to appear, will not be able to do so. However, someone could build a Fedora, sideload it, and even distribute the bits and pieces to streamline that sideloading. Those who enjoy unrolling their own loops might even build a Gentoo version. What I wonder about is how big an impact is this going to make on Type 2 hypervisors like VMware Workstation, Parallels, and so forth. Makes you go,
Now, who would have thought that gaming the telco market to make Americans pay more for a service they already pay too much for, running over an infrastructure that they mostly supported with their tax money, and held in power by one of the most active political lobbies in the country, would eventually earn some backlash? Well, we did. And the Twit Army did. And most technorati did. But it seems that as if it's finally sinking in at Comcast. Yesterday on C-SPAN, David Cohen, the senior executive VP who is Comcast's political face, announced that Comcast would be willing to ban paid prioritization, also called fast lanes, if they were limited exceptions for specialized services, which would be for the benefit of the consumer. And that's a quote. This comes as Comcast's already low consumer satisfaction and brand respect was taking yet another beating after publicly proclaiming their pledge of support for net neutrality and the lack of fast lanes since 2014, then supporting the push to repeal net neutrality, and then quietly removing the paid prioritization pledge within hours of FCC Chairman Ajit Pai's announcement that he would repeal the open internet laws. Since then, 35 states have bills or strong pushes for a bill to protect net neutrality, and they're all willing to take on the FCC. This is an egg-on-their-face moment for Comcast, who, in proposing the ban on paid prioritization with exceptions for special services, is essentially accepting the 2010 FCC open internet regulation that Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon spent millions of dollars to defeat, which led to the most recent laws. In other words, they just figured out that we don't like being cheated. I hope they kept their receipt for their Ajit Pai gift box.
Hey, psst. Bad bots are hiding in your data center. You know, more than half of all the traffic on the internet last year came from bots. And bad bots execute online fraud, data theft, and distributed DDoS attacks. Despite more awareness, they move on Twitter and others who are trying very hard to get rid of them. They continue to dog e-commerce, and they're evolving their tactics to evade detection. But where do they live? Most bad bots live on gambling and airline websites, and most pose as web browser users, including those using Chrome, Firefox, Internet Explorer, and Safari, with about 10% as mobile browser users. The biggest shift in 2017, though, was bots hiding out in data centers. Some 82% are now operating out of cloud-based accounts versus 60% the year before. Operating out of the cloud data centers is all the rage for bot runners now. It's inexpensive to spin up a cloud server, for example, and it appears to the operators of the cloud services as a legit user. According to researchers, hosting provides really a legal way for the bots to distribute themselves. It's cheap and accessible, two words that bot users and bot operators love a lot.
So, our friends at the FBI, guys, you really got to check your own toolbox. And that showdown with Apple? Duh. So, the Department of Justice Internal Watchdog, the Office of the Inspector General, has concluded that the FBI may have overstepped when it failed to exhaust internal options before pressing ahead in the high-profile 2016 legal clash with Apple. The OIG issued a 17-page report this last Tuesday, which describes the FBI's action 2 years ago during the so-called FBI versus Apple showdown. That case centered around the FBI's attempt to unlock the iPhone 5C used by Syed Rizwan Farooq, the man behind a terrorist attack in San Bernardino, California in December 2015. Quote, "We believe," that is the Cryptologic and Electronic Analysis Unit, "should have checked with the Operational Technology Division's trusted vendors for possible solutions before advising the OTD management, FBI leadership, or the U.S. Attorney's Office that there was no other technical alternative and that compelling Apple's assistance was necessary to search the Farooq iPhone," the report states. In other words,
Now, you know those ICOs or initial coin offerings that everybody saw, from Kodak to porn companies? The ones that they tried to tie their companies to because, well, they wanted blockchain or crypto somewhere in their company description. Well, surprise, they're all frauds. Well, not all of them, but more than 4 in 5 of them. And that's the conclusion of a study by the Satis Group, who looked at all ICOs with a market cap of $50 million or more. Now, 81% of the ICOs were out-and-out scams with no discernible way to reach market. 6% were failed, meaning that they raised funding but were abandoned or refunded. 5% were dead, completely funded but inexplicably dropping off the net. And only 8% of all ICOs in the study actually made it to an exchange. That's the point at which an ICO investor could actually trade the coin and maybe make some money. To further compound the sorrow, of the few ICOs that actually made it to trading, only 3.8% could be considered successful and 1.6% promising. The TLDR is this: if you invest any money in an ICO, there's about a 5% chance that you'll see your money again. Well, that does it for the blips. Next up, we've got the bites. But before we get there, let's go ahead and take a moment to pause and thank the sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech. Now, this episode is brought to you by the Cloud Spanner from Google Cloud Platform. Now, we've all come to expect that distributed databases can't be both relational and scalable. That's one of those immutable rules. That's a trade-off that you make when you're designing your database and your service. But what if you didn't have to make that trade-off? What if you could have a fully managed database service that's consistent, that scales horizontally across data centers, and speaks SQL? Well, guess what? It's here. Introducing Cloud Spanner, a mission-critical relational database service from Google Cloud Platform. Built from the ground up and battle-tested at Google for strong consistency and high availability at global scale. Now, Cloud Spanner delivers scalability, high transaction performance, and strong consistency across rows, regions, and continents with an industry-leading 99.999%, that's those five nines, available SLA. Now, there's no planned downtime, enterprise-grade security, multi-language support, client libraries in C#, Go, Java, Node.js, PHP, Python, and Ruby, JDBC drivers for connectivity with popular third-party tools, and their pricing is simple and predictable. In other words, Google just took away all of your reasons not to try. They took away all of the reasons why you may not be comfortable, and they've made Cloud Spanner the number one choice for your next project. Now, to learn more about Cloud Spanner, just go to g.co/getspanner today. That's g.co/getspanner. One more time, g.co/getspanner. And we thank Cloud Spanner from Google Cloud Platform for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Gentlemen, let's get to the blips. Now, we were originally not going to touch this one because it's kind of close to both Cheebert and I, but I think we have to. The more I think about it, the more I realize we do need to talk about the FCC blocking the sale of Chinese technology to protect national security. Now, this is a story that we've talked about a little bit in passing for the last couple of weeks, and it's getting hot. Now, Chinese technology vendor Huawei and ZTE could soon be prevented from selling products to U.S. companies and organizations that receive broadband funding from the FCC. In other words, the FCC is using their programs that provide broadband expansion funds to say, if you deal with those companies, you will no longer get those funds. FCC Chairman Ajit Pai's new proposal would prevent the USF, that's the Universal Service Fund, from being used to purchase equipment or services from any communication equipment or service providers identified as posing a national security risk to communication networks or the communication supply chain. And again, those vendors identified have been Huawei and ZTE. Now, these proposals. This whole taking away USF from companies that are going to use those vendors comes just as President Donald Trump has imposed new tariffs and other penalties on Chinese goods. So this is seen as sort of a tit for tat. This is a bit more of a push, a bit more incentive for China to make a deal. But the proposed FCC policy has in its roots that 2012 congressional report that said that both Huawei and ZTE equipment should not be used by U.S. government systems because of their ties to the Chinese government. The report also encouraged private U.S. companies to consider the long-term security risks associated with doing business with either of those two companies for equipment or services. In other words, they want them to seek other vendors. Chibert. We have to be very careful about what we say here because I think the confidentiality of the NOC still applies and we still have friends and we still have a presence in this business. But this is something that actually even predates 2012. This has been around basically since Huawei and ZTE started making equipment, right?
No, this has been around, or at least this attitude within Capitol Hill has been around ever since the Chinese company Lenovo bought the ThinkPad line from IBM.
Yep.
Remember that time when the ThinkPads were coming preloaded with malware?
Yep. Which and they didn't call it malware, by the way. They said, no.
This is a feature.
It's a feature. We like this.
So there has been a growing level of distrust within government purchasing groups for quite a while. And, so we really got to stick just to facts.
I know, right? I'm starting to feel that.
that's why Padre and I are both nervous. There's an awful lot of rumors, and I do say rumors, that sadly, for us to substantiate, would risk our friends' jobs.
At least.
Yeah. But it makes you go, So here's one thing that I can say that is, it's a rumor that I can share, and that is an attitude within government purchasing agents saying, how the heck was Huawei and ZTE able to, in some people's minds, buy a really, really, really big segment of the market and not have government backing.
Mm-hmm.
Huawei and ZTE have both denied that. So we don't know. Apparently, well, it's an ongoing investigation, right?
We don't know officially, but I mean, at some point, it does go beyond rumor. At some point, you're like, when you look at how fast they built up their market cap and how fast they built up their manufacturing capabilities and how much money they had to buy the things that they bought, including buying a lot of technology from HP and licensing things from HP that cost an incredible amount of money and then developing those products into something slightly different. You can't just do that as a startup. You need not just a couple of billionaires behind you. You need a state that is willing to sort of look the other way while you do the things that you need to do.
And it's not just HP. It's also Ericsson and Siemens.
Yep.
You know, guys, we're selling the crown jewels here.
Yeah.
And I'm really starting to wonder because, you know, I've had a lot of cases where the sad part is corporations over there, let's just use the word over there, have a stronger and bigger tie to government than a lot of the Western world. So even though I've had, you know, I've had researchers at privately sponsored research conventions on convention facilities, trying to do a VPN back to our servers here in Hawaii and consistently being hit by a man in the middle attempt that looks like they're attempting to grab their credentials. So there is a different attitude. And what I can also say is there is an attitude within the security world. The Chinese government is very, very patient. They collect grains of sand, but you have enough patience And pretty soon those grains of sand add up to their own beach.
Right.
So, you know, that's enough of the ranting on that. Let's get back to the main topic. The federal government is basically saying, we don't think you should use this gear because we're afraid it's going to phone home. I think that's the bottom line, right?
Well, kind of. I want to bring Curtis into this discussion, and I want to do it by talking about an episode of New Screensavers I did with Leo Laporte about 2 weeks ago. One of the mailbag questions, those are the questions we ask at the end of the show, was from a user who wanted to know if it was possible for him to buy a phone that was in no way, shape, or form made in, constructed in, assembled in China. And he was worried about spyware. He was worried about what we're talking about in the story. And we discussed this. We said, yes, there are some manufacturers that don't touch China at all, that actually make all their components elsewhere. However, the bigger problem, and Qibert, I'm with you on this, is the bigger problem is at some point, if you want that device to be useful, it's got to communicate with the larger network of the internet. And there's so much of that is run by Huawei and has ZTE equipment in it. And as you mentioned, we don't really know. We haven't done a thorough study on whether or not that equipment phones home or what it does. Curtis, is this a concern on the enterprise side? Because, I mean, Huawei has been incredibly aggressive with pricing. They have provided some decent equipment. I had an experience like Qibert where, for some reason, there was a Huawei switch that kept breaking my VPNs. But as it turned out, it was just a really, really poorly designed piece of equipment. It wasn't malicious. Is this just rumor? Is this the slander? Or is there actually something here?
I tend to think that there may well be something here. And my concern, and the concern of a lot of people, isn't so much with the endpoint devices, the phones and the laptops, as it is with the big core routers. It's easy to forget that Huawei is one of, realistically, about a half dozen companies on Earth that is capable of bidding on projects to provide the very largest core routers for major corporations and ISPs.
It's like what? It's Huawei, it's Cisco, HP, Huawei, maybe
Juniper,
maybe Extreme. I don't know with that acquisition. Maybe they're more edge. Yeah,
and I tend to think there's probably at least one European still in there, but it's a very, very limited vendor community. And those are devices, I mean, face it, if you really wanted to do massive surveillance of data, it's far more efficient to do the collection at the core router than it is to do it from millions upon millions of endpoints. So is it a concern to the enterprise? Oh, absolutely. I am reasonably certain that there are companies out there that for various reasons would not ever consider a core router from Huawei because they know that they would get serious questions from their government-based clients if they did. Others follow those companies' leads. This has become a major issue for Huawei, and they're becoming more and more aggressive in trying to address it. As you say, I've seen press releases on new equipment, and there's no question that they are very, very aggressive on their list prices, which means that when the sales folks come to talk, they're going to be doing wheeling and dealing that makes these products really difficult for someone who has bean counters looking over their shoulder to pass up.
Right. And Qibert, we can talk about security and we can talk about rumors. We can talk about what might or might not be happening. But ultimately, when it gets up to the C-suite and they see an order of magnitude less for a Huawei or ZTE solution for whatever they're trying to deploy, that's going to speak louder than security concerns that haven't been proven, right?
I really hope not. But yeah, I do agree. You know, there I have seen way, way too many management teams that have been so hell-bent on saving a buck that I swear they'd sell their grandma.
Right. But that's the thing. Yeah. I mean, we have suspicions, and we both have seen things that have made us go, But there's no hard proof. We don't really have any proof that things are being done maliciously on Huawei boxes. And we've dealt with the big iron. We've seen the big iron. We've seen the teams that are making their big iron. I think there's a lot of reasons not to buy Huawei equipment, specifically because I don't think it's the best equipment on the market. But to start saying, well, you don't buy them because they're Chinese brands and Chinese brands can't be trusted, I'm very concerned about that slippery slope. Because that becomes a nationalistic way for you to say, no, we don't buy anything from Japan and we don't buy anything from China and we definitely don't buy from Russia. And you know what? Those Canadians, them and their syrup, they've always got me a little worried.
Yeah. Well, Emily the Strange out of the chat room actually made a really, really great point. Those cell sites with the LTE or especially those 5G cell sites that are starting to roll out, those aren't U.S. made anymore.
Nope.
You know, we on one hand, I like the fact that we're turning into a global economy. I like the fact that I talk on a regular basis to folks in Europe. In fact, I actually set my schedule so that I can talk to Europe on a regular basis. I also set my schedule so I can talk to East Asia on a regular basis. But the reality is, you know, there has been a level of distrust, and I'm, you know, my ethnic background is Chinese, you know, half Chinese, half Korean, and my family is originally from Northern Mongolia, but I have a distrust in the way that their government does things.
True.
When I have something that key to an enterprise or organization, I'm hoping that my organizations that I work with will see that maybe we need to reinvest in American businesses beyond just the level of distrust. So I don't know. I'm ranting here. Take me away.
Curtis, Curtis, give us some voice of reason here.
Well, when it comes to wondering why people get upset, there are two words that I think play with a lot of these. Those words are backdoor. Now, we've said that we haven't seen active incidents of the Huawei or LTE devices calling home, stealing information, skimming user data, or any of those things. But where a lot of people worry is whether there are, in fact, back doors deep within the code that runs these devices, such that were there to be some sort of heightening of tension, were there to be a specific incident where it would be advantageous for someone in the Chinese military to know what was going on, that there is code that could be activated to provide that, and that we wouldn't be able to respond in time, whether that backdoor is to steal information or just to shut down nodes on the internet. So it becomes one of those things where it is all about paranoia, but we have to admit that we have within both enterprises and the government individuals whose job it is to be paranoid. We depend on their paranoia to save us from some of the worst behavior that could happen. And I think right now that paranoid voice is looming large in the ears of a lot of decision makers. And I frankly don't know what these two companies could do to silence that voice.
But see, that's what I'm talking about. I totally get it. And Chibert, I'm with you. Curtis, I'm with you. I believe there's some prudence. You should take some prudence to make sure that critical infrastructure is secured, including secured from our own government, by the way. So, I mean, that's when you ask independent researchers to look at the code. You actually pen test. You do a true pen test of equipment. All the things that we've talked about on Twyte. I get very concerned, though, whenever we start turning this into a nationalistic conversation, just because that always leads to bad things, super unintended consequences. And I think that's where we're going. Yes, Huawei and ZTE have done some shady things. Yes, Chinese companies have done some shady, shady things. The question becomes, do we use that as a basis for saying all of your products are now suspect and therefore should not be sold in our country? I don't know. I don't know if I'm willing to make that jump. And more than that, I don't know if that's a good jump to make. Because in the past, when that's happened, when you can rely on nationalistic fervor to sell your product over a foreign product, that's led to the national products becoming of lower quality because they know they have no competitors, because they know there's nowhere else you can go to buy. And again, that would be one of those unintended consequences down the line. So I'm stuck. I understand the security implications. I'm saying before we start saying those products are bad because they're Chinese, maybe we use the skills we have as IT people and as security researchers to actually get some hard proof. That's all I'm saying. My rant is over. Chibert, Curtis, do you want to throw anything else on the fire?
I'm going to sidetrack this just a second. Jay brought up out of the chat room a really good point. Perhaps the global economy must eventually have open source style manufacturing of commodities, slowing innovation. This makes patents difficult unless a type of patent where the set price can be used by any manufacturer. Kind of an interesting point, but I'm going to sidetrack his statement and say there are some really interesting ramifications, because Cisco just recently said they're going to now open iOS to white boxes. So that means we might someday see non-US, non-Cisco made iOS routers. And if you design it big enough, we're now starting to talk about white box core routers, which certainly makes life very interesting, don't you think?
Yes, it does. Well, Chibert, how about this? Let's stop here. Let's stop on this topic. We'll move on. However, in the post show, do you want to let loose with just a couple of stories that we got?
Yeah, let's see if we can avoid being sued, though.
Okay, good call. All right, let's go ahead and move on to the next bite. And this one actually gets me excited. And that's SpaceX just got the FCC approval to blast off into the WISP market. That's right. They're going to become a wireless ISP. Now, the FCC took a look yesterday at SpaceX's plan to provide global satellite broadband services. Of course, this is going to be with a series of low Earth orbiting satellites, and they see nothing wrong with the plan. Now, quote, this is the first approval of a U.S. licensed satellite constellation to provide broadband services using a new generation of LEO orbit satellites. And the FCC also said, with this action, the commission takes another step to increase high-speed broadband availability and competition in the United States, unquote. Now, this has been a plan of several companies for quite a while. Boeing has been trying to get into the game. You may remember the Iridium system, which is still currently up there. But this is Elon Musk's SpaceX saying, no, we think we can do it better. We think we can do it faster. We think we can do it cheaper. And we think we can cover more of the planet with newer technologies. That's got me incredibly interested. Now, the plan calls for a constellation of, get this, 4,425 microsatellites in low Earth orbit. Now, they want to provide low-latency broadband specifically to rural and remote places with little or no internet access, and then also improve speeds and competition in areas with so-so access. Now, they are operating under the code name of Starlink. Who knows if that's actually going to work? I was thinking Space Tesla would probably be better. They've already got a car up there. This is a fascinating project, and if you dig down deep into the actual tech specs, you can see why this is not like previous generations of LEO satellite constellations. They've got a lot of self-healing, they've got a lot of very fast processing, and they've also got some tricks that they've learned with using very constructive use of distortion, atmospheric distortion, to correct for latency issues. Chibert, let me throw this over to you first. They're saying that this might be operational mid-2020. SpaceX has actually been pretty good about deadlines. Do you think this actually could be? Could they get more than 4,000 satellites up by 2020 and have them operational?
Well, you got to keep in mind, these guys are talking about really small satellites. And considering that heavy lift, the Falcon heavy lift, that could one Falcon Heavy lift. My best thumb gas swag, I would say Falcon can probably drop in a couple hundred of those microsatellites, don't you think?
Yeah. And actually, there's a great graphic. I'm not sure if SpaceX did it, but they showed the deployment of microsats and how it would just open up the cowling. And then they're basically ejected, like spring ejected out into their proper orbits. It is a fast. I mean, I love space. Space was my first love. So this really makes me geek out.
Here's the other thing. SpaceX has been a very big player in the world of swarm control satellites.
Right.
And when you start having a swarm control over satellites to be able to shift things around, you know, antenna orientations and things like that, I think we are not far from being able to literally have the Star Trek communicator badge in the middle of the Sahara Desert calling home to say, "Hi, Mom. What do you think, man?"
Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, it's all about the bandwidth. Curtis, let me pull you in on this, because I've used satellite systems before, and they always have the advertised speed, you know, 4,800 bits per second. Realistically, I was getting something closer to 2,400 bits per second. And I don't think 9,600 bits per second is even possible over a satellite connection currently using what we've got up there. This is supposed to rival wired connectivity to your home. And I, when I first saw that, I thought, oh, that's ridiculous. It's not going to be possible. But then, again, you read down into the tech, and it does look like they can actually meet some of those goals. If they could provide ubiquitous connectivity at a price that was comparable to a wired connection to your home, this isn't just another service provider. This is a complete change to how we think of broadband.
Oh, it's got to be one of those things that just irritates the daylights out of all of the cell-based ISPs out there, because this allows the possibility of having uninterrupted data coverage. You know, right now, even with the best of the data providers, once you get out into the boonies, there are big holes in the coverage. You really cannot go coast to coast and have solid wireless data unless perhaps you stay on a couple of the major interstate highways. So if you start looking at what they're doing, imagine they've got all of these up and they have the ability to talk to their automobiles coast to coast. They have the ability to update the Tesla automobiles wirelessly coast to coast. Plus, they can begin to do things, I have to imagine, like doing very, very high accuracy location off of these. Right now, if you think about it, if you let a little settle happen and you can see 7 GPS satellites, you can get very good location. Imagine if you were doing time-based location and you could see 100 satellites. I can imagine getting down to something that approaches millimeter accuracy from a satellite-based location sensor. This is a game changer for a lot of different industries.
Right. Well, Eric Duckman is wondering if this is more of a medium orbit system, but definitely not. Compare this. When you think of satellite, you can think of something like the HughesNet, which is a satellite internet service. They're orbiting at about 22,000 miles. This is going to be closer to 700 miles. So this is not just low Earth orbit. This is very low Earth orbit. And that's why they can get the latencies so far down. Now, one of the other things about this is they are looking at distributing over the United States first. So they need about 800 satellites. If they can get 800 up, that will cover the continental United States, and that becomes your testbed system. Then you go out from there. You just expand the constellation. There is a question on how often you will have to replenish the satellites in the constellation, because the lower you get into orbit, the more drag you catch, which means you either need to refuel your satellites so that they can boost themselves back up to the proper orbit, or you just expect them to die and you need to be replacing them on a regular basis. Those things still have to be worked out. This is just proof of concept. But again, this sounds like yeah, Cheebert, like you're saying, this sounds like Star Trek communicator stuff. It being connected anywhere, I have clear view to the sky.
Well, let's put it this way. Global Star, which is actually a reseller for Iridium, has sub-channels. They're basically, they're at the very fringe edge of the Iridium data channels. And they, just by offering, they now have a $65 a month plan where I can send an unlimited number of 240-character text messages, both inbound and outbound. Now, the cool thing is this will work everywhere except the poles. And with that kind of coverage, I can fit, you know, if I do some data encoding, I can fit an awful lot of data into 240 characters. Now, if we start getting it into super low Earth orbit, because Iridium's fair, you know, it's low Earth orbit, but it's at the high end of that band. If I only have to punch through about 700 miles of atmosphere and weather and so forth, now we're starting to talk about, instead of having a modem that's maybe about that big, if you can, like a deck of cards, that's how big my Global Star modem is for the Raspberry Pi. I am going to imagine a reasonably robust modem for Starlink is probably going to be about the size of a golf ball with batteries. Now, when you start getting that small, now all of a sudden we can have temperature and intrusion sensors on refrigerated containers. We could probably get it cheap enough that we could track high priority packages as they go across country. I'll bet you Amazon's going to be a customer because they're really big on having packages delivered on time, to the point where they are starting to pay penalties in some cases if they don't make it. It's to the point where UPS drivers will sometimes mark a package as delivered even though they didn't deliver it, because there's so much pressure on this. So tracking food, tracking high priority packages, and being able to do it internationally is a pretty big deal.
Right.
You know,
right.
To the point where the federal government was getting ready to hand me a lot of money for food safety tracking, just so we can keep track, you know, make sure that gallon of ice cream never really defrosted.
Another tidbit about this, because I Am Special asked about, he thought he heard lasers in reference to the story. Yes, actually, one of the proposals is that the satellites would use lasers to communicate with each other. So that's super low latency communication between the satellites. But then they would still use the Ku band to do terrestrial communications, because shooting a laser through 700 miles of vacuum and atmosphere, it's not going to work out so well. And actually, Curtis, you're a ham, right? I mean, Ku is the most efficient way to get into space.
Oh, it's a very good way to get into space. And you know, let's remember that we are, in fact, talking line of sight. And it's possible to do line of sight communications with very low power. I've talked to the ISS using a handy talkie. So this is not a serious technological trick at all when you're talking about the RF bands that they're using. You know, Cheebert talked about, he mentioned a word that I think is going to be important when this goes to full rollout, and that's international. It's one thing to say that they're going to provide this for the United States, but let's remember that there are an awful lot of countries out there that have internet kill switches on the gateway routers for their nations. There are any number of countries that have the capability to shut down access to the global internet from their nation in the event of unrest or attack, or because they just want to. Padre, you mentioned at the very beginning of the show, or when we were getting ready, the idea that when you go to China, it's tough getting a VPN to work because of that nation's control over its routers. But if you don't go through their routers, if the access of your citizens to the internet or of visiting citizens to the internet isn't dependent upon what happens through your national routers, that has the potential to be exceptionally disruptive on a geopolitical basis. And knowing Elon Musk, he's thought about that a lot.
Right, right. Well, I mean, think about it. You might be walking around with your cell phone. You might have a Wi-Fi connection at home. Maybe you even have a hotspot that uses a different provider, but they're still all using terrestrial-based networks that can be shut down. If you're using a space-based network, unless the country is willing to blot out the skies with KU interference, you can't stop it. You can't stop me from getting to a network that's not under your control. That appeals to the sort of semi-anarchist side that I might have on the dark side of my personality.
Hey, but, Padre.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why there's so much pollution in Beijing. They're blotting out the sky.
Blotting out the KU band? Maybe so. Now, actually, one of the other things that's been mentioned in the chat room is about how difficult it was to set up satellite radios. And Chibert, I don't know if you ever used one back in the day. I used to have a set that you had to set up, and then you actually had to look at the tables to find out where the satellite might be at the time, and you'd have to mm-hmm. aim it exactly until you started getting signal from that satellite, and then it would have to track it, which was...
I had a briefcase in Marsat phone.
That was horrible. It was cool, but it was horrible because it was difficult to get the connection, and it was almost impossible to maintain the connection for a period of time.
It was bad to the point where we actually had a HP programmable calculator
right.
in the suitcase, so we could punch in our longitude, latitude, and time of day at GMT, just so we knew where to point the stupid thing.
Yeah. Well, today's sets, because we've made great advances in RF design, they use a flat panel, and they basically just steer the beam. So it's pointed at the sky, and you'll find a satellite. And if you've got a constellation of satellites, it can even do better than that. It'll look for the satellite with the lowest latency, this is kind of amazing technology. I mean, I want to see it work. I want to see a prototype. I want to see what kind of pricing they might have. But if they can deliver this, this is not just an IT development. This is a worldwide communication / global awareness development. And I think that's kind of awesome.
Yeah, well, I carry a Globalstar modem with me when I travel. I put it into emergency mode, which is basically 20 messages in and out. But that only costs me $12 a month, and I just carry that as my emergency. In fact, I'm going to go to a wedding in Vermont in October. And considering my experience with some of the areas of Vermont where there's nothing, I want to have the ability to go and be able to call for help.
Right.
Don't call me paranoid. And something like this Starlink system would mean that would be a lot less expensive, a lot more ubiquitous, and possibly even better coverage, which would be amazing if you ask me.
Well, gentlemen, unfortunately, we have used up all the time we have allotted for the show. Is there any final words you want to throw in there before we bid farewell to the Twilight Riot? Curtis, Chibert?
I just want to say thank you to Emily the Strange.
Yes.
She's actually put in an amazing number of really cool comments. Thank you very much.
I love Emily. Curtis?
Sorry, Kurt.
No worries. No, I'll also add my voice of thanks to Emily and the rest of the Twilight. It's been a great conversation today. And it's interesting that today in the conversation we've had, we've seen sort of both sides. We've seen some information that has made us think that things are looking awful, that there's nothing but paranoia and distrust out there. And on the other side, we've seen the possibility of something happen that could lead us to even better days ahead. So I think that may well be the tech industry wrapped up in a nutshell.
Indeed. And I also do want to extend a personal hello to everyone who is celebrating this Good Friday. That's actually where I came from, and I'll be heading back to in just a bit. If you celebrate this, thank you very much for listening to the show, and I wish you the best of year. And if you don't, you know what? May this be an awesome Friday for you because you're an awesome person. Chibert, Curtis, thank you so very, very, very much. Folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour, actually more like 55 minutes, listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 very low Earth orbit satellites. want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Of course, that means Curtis. Of course, that means Chibert. And actually, Chibert, could you tell us where people can find you and your work, even as you try to figure out what's going on with your weather patterns?
I am ADVNETLAB at Twitter, Advanced Net Lab, and I'm also Chibert at twit.tv. I do apologize to our viewers. We sometimes, the gremlins just get the best of us, and we will go and shift it around, and the regularly scheduled guest will be back just a little later.
Indeed, indeed. Sometimes it happens, not often, but yeah, we still had a fun show. Curtis, I know you are in the house hunt. I know that you are moving around, but where can people find you and your work?
Well, no matter where I lay my head, my Twitter handle will also always be at KG4GWA, and I do tweet out my stuff. I'm having fun settling into my new position at Dark Reading. A lot of stuff to cover, a lot of interesting things going on. So we've got some more great articles coming up. And as I said, getting ready in just a couple of weeks to head out to RSA in San Francisco. That's going to be a great time. I'm looking forward to having some wonderful stories to tell on TWIET after that conference.
And sadly, I will be in Rome. Hopefully we can see maybe one day or a couple of hours before I have to jump on a plane, but it would have been wonderful to experience RSA with you and to spend more time with Franklin. And folks, also thanks to you, to the person who watches, who listens each week. We wouldn't have a show for all these years without you. We want to make it easier for you to get TWIET. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/TWIET. That's T-W-I-E-T. There you will find all of our back episodes, all the way back to episode number one, along with our show notes. If you want to see the links for the stories that we talked about in the blips or the ones we discussed in the bites, or if we've got a guest that you want to get in contact with, maybe they're offering a solution that you think might work for you, again, just go to twit.tv/TWIET. And as long as you're there, why not subscribe? It's the best way to support the show. You can get an audio version, a video version, or a high-definition video version automatically into your device of choice. It's all part of the experience that is TWIET. Also, don't forget that you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. Although right now I'm off Twitter for 72 hours because of the Easter Twitter one. But normally it's the place to find me, what I'm doing, where I am, when I'm jumping around the world, when I'm Ultra Instinct Goku. That was a weird picture. Sometimes I tweet when I'm really tired, folks, and they don't always make sense. But again, go to twitter.com/PadreSJ and follow me. Finally, thanks to everyone here who makes this show possible. Of course, our engineers, Alex and Jemmer B and Burke, and to our spectacular, wonderful, incredibly wise TD, Kevin. Kevin, do you have a mic on? Because this is normally the time of the show where we offer you a chance at redemption to see if you were actually paying attention. Is that a yes or a no? You know, Grump, we talked about this, right? You have to communicate with the words that you've been given. Yeah? No?
Okay.
Yeah? Okay, good. Okay. So, from the show, what does WISP stand for?
Winter in summer, please.
It's written in the doc, man. It's just wireless internet service provider. But thank you very much for playing, Kevin. We'll give you another chance next week. It's right in the doc, man.
No, it just says
I gave you an easy one this
global
time.
Global WISP market.
Oh, maybe you'll get it next time. Until then, I'm Father Robert Ballas here, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep TWIET. This was your Good Friday gimme, man. It was right there. I even clicked on it so you'd see what I was talking about.